Case number 19-5106, Royce Corley, appellant versus William Pelham Barr, Attorney General et al. Mr. Boquet Lindell, amicus curiae, Mr. Pfaffenroth for the appellees.
May I proceed, Your Honors?
Good morning, yes.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Noah Boquet Lindell for the court appointed amicus in support of Mr. Corley. Over 6 years ago, Mr. Corley submitted requests to three components of the Department of Justice under FOIA and the Privacy Act. Those statutes require agencies and courts to strike a balance between privacy interests and the fundamental need for disclosure, with FOIA placing an especially large thumb on the scale in favor of the latter. Yet throughout this case, the government has made a series of privacy-only arguments on every major issue. Those arguments conflict with FOIA's general philosophy of disclosure. In nevertheless granting summary judgment to the agencies in this case, the district court made three significant errors. First, the court allowed the FBI and the Executive Office for U.S. Attorneys to withhold documents under FOIA Exemption 3, even though the Child Victims and Witnesses' Rights Act is not a withholding statute and does not require withholding of the documents at issue here. Second, the court granted summary judgment to EOUSA when EOUSA failed to release any documents under the Privacy Act and never invoked any Privacy Act exemptions. And third, the court entered summary judgment without even recognizing that the Justice Management Division had failed to even conduct a search, though Mr. Corley had included a copy of his FOIA request with his appeal letter. For these reasons, we believe the judgment below should be vacated or reversed on these issues. Now, starting with the first issue, the Exemption 3 issue. In order to withhold documents under Exemption 3, an agency has to meet two steps of the standard. First, they have to show that the Child Victims Act is a withholding statute as a general matter. And second, even if it is, the agencies have to show that the documents that Mr. Corley is seeking fall within the statute's reach. If they fail to meet either of those two steps, then they are not able to withhold documents under Exemption 3. And here, the agencies would fail at both steps. At step one, in terms of determining whether this is a withholding statute to begin with, Department of Justice versus Julian shows that this statute is not a withholding statute.
Well, Mr. Boquet Lindell, would you start with the language of the statute instead of the Supreme Court decision? It says, the statute says that all documents concerning a child shall be kept in a secure place to which no person who doesn't have the reason to know shall be able to see them. And then it has only one exception, right? It just says one exception. It says that it says they can be disclosed only to persons who by their participation in the proceedings have reason to know. So why isn't this just the standard is the statute says that that a disclosure statute is one that, quote, requires that matters be withheld from the public in such a manner as to leave no discretion. And this doesn't seem to leave any discretion. It prohibits, it requires that they be kept secret, and it has one exception.
Right, and that again,
forget the Supreme Court in Lindell for a minute. Why isn't this statute just on its face an Exemption 3 disclosure statute?
Well, because it does allow, it authorizes disclosure to certain people. And again, it's sort of hard to—
Yeah, but it's a limited disclosure to people in the context of a statute that requires that it all be kept, shall be kept in a secure place to which no person who does not have access has access. It's a blanket, it's a prohibition on—
If I may follow up on Judge Tatel's point, isn't the key word only in 3509D1 double I, isn't that the key word only? Disclose only, meaning you don't disclose to anybody else?
Well, again, I think this is why I think it's a little hard to divorce this from the ruling in Julian, because the statutes at issue there were very similar. The only people who were allowed to have access to the pre-sentence reports in the laws at issue in Julian were the defendant and the defendant's counsel. And yet the Supreme Court said that because it allowed for that disclosure, it authorized that disclosure, it's not a withholding statute. And here, we don't have exactly the same level, you know, of complete mandatory authorization, but we do have this situation where it clearly carves out people who are authorized to receive this. There's also subsection D4, which again reiterates that it does not prohibit disclosure to—
I don't mean to interrupt you, but before we leave the Supreme Court decision, it says, I'm looking at the language of the statute. It says that Rule 32 and the Parole Act didn't qualify because they were designed, quote, not to protect the reports from disclosure. Not to protect the reports from disclosure, whereas this statute does.
Well, again, though, in Julian, the statutes at issue there only allowed it to be disclosed to certain people. And so again, you know, we have this situation where there's disclosure allowed to a certain small subset of people, but not necessarily to the public. And so they are pretty much on all fours. You have situations where both of them authorize disclosure to defendants and defendants' counsel. In neither case do you have an explicit time frame for that disclosure. And in both cases, with the Parole Act in Julian and here with the Child Victims Act, the people who receive the disclosure are allowed to hold on to it, even though they try to prevent further disclosure outward in both cases. Mm-hmm. And in Julian itself, it notes that there was a series of changes made to the statute in order to facilitate disclosure. And it says, for example, in 1966, they amended the rule to allow the courts to disclose this information to defendants. And then there were a series of further amendments that went even further after that. But the court was noting that this was a series of amendments, starting with the one that allowed courts to disclose this information to defendants, that showed that there was a desire to facilitate some disclosure. And the other thing to keep in mind here in terms of the text of the statute is that this statute was designed to balance the privacy interests at issue with the constitutional rights of defendants, as well as the rights of these other actors that the statute specifically created and allowed access to the proceedings, guardians ad litem, adult attendants, et cetera.
Mr. Bokett-Lindell, in the context of a FOIA search, Mr. Corley is not a criminal defendant.
Right, yes. And as far as his claim that he is able to directly receive this information under the statute, there is this question about whether he still qualifies as a defendant because he was the defendant in the proceedings at issue, but those proceedings have ended. I will note that when he requested these documents, he was seeking them in order to aid in his appeal. So while the trial proceedings were over, it was still part of his case. But regardless, the question for Exemption 3 is not whether under the statute himself he's a defendant, because even in Julian, the people there were no longer defendants. They were inmates, as the court said. They were not in the periods of time where the statute explicitly allowed for disclosure to them. They were just sitting in jail. They had already been sentenced.
What is your response to the government's distinction of Julian?
Based on the NRDC case, Your Honor?
The government argues that in Julian, the individual involved was a beneficiary of the disclosure, which is not true here.
Right, Your Honor. Well, I mean, first of all, he is in the sense that he is one of the people who was allowed to have this information under the statute. But more fundamentally, that argument doesn't deal with the Exemption 3 portion of the discussion in Julian. That deals with the Exemption 5 discussion in Julian. There were two exemptions at issue in Julian. And if you read through Julian, it does the entire Exemption 3 analysis without even talking about this question of a special access right. It's when it gets to Exemption 5 where they say normally we would not allow this information to be disclosed, but because this is the subject of the report themselves, they're the beneficiary of that privilege, that discovery privilege, that therefore we would allow this to be disclosed to this particular person. And if you look at Justice Scalia's dissent, that's where he joins issue with the majority, is this question of Exemption 5 and saying we are creating this special access right for one person. That's not part of the Exemption 3 discussion in Julian. And so I think that when we're talking about Exemption 3, that special access issue is not directly relevant. It's a question of whether the statute creates an authorization of disclosure to particular people. And one other thing I'd note about that on the text is if you look at subsection H of the statute where it creates these guardians ad litem, it has subsection H2 of the statute, which specifically says the guardian ad litem may have access to all reports, evaluations, and records except attorney's work product necessary to effectively advocate for the child. So there we have yet another example. In addition to the privacy provisions themselves, including D4, we now have H2 in the statute where they're specifically creating this avenue for certain people to have access to this information.
Well, but the language of FOIA Exemption 3 itself that provides for statutory exemptions doesn't suggest that the statutory exemption has to be complete, right? I mean, the Exemption 3A Romanet 2 says, right, a statute establishes particular criteria for withholding or refers to particular types of matters to be withheld, right? It doesn't have to be everything is withheld or a categorical withholding of information.
Right. And again, the category that we're talking about in terms of what's even covered by the provision itself is this specific set of documents that refer to a child. But again, even within that, there's this question of, is it requiring withholding entirely? And again, that's where Julian comes into play here. Because even though, yes, it's referring to a specific set of documents, in Julian, it was referencing one particular document. It was referencing a pre-sentence report. So by the text of Exemption 3, it would seem to fall within Exemption 3. It's saying, here is this document that we are only allowing one person and their attorney to see. And there are certain types of information within that that even that defendant can't see. And that information is withheld under Exemption 3.
Mr. Bocatlin, are you aware of our decision in a case called United States versus Bryce? Do you know about that case?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
I ask because I don't usually like to bring up cases that aren't mentioned in the brief. It's not mentioned in the government's brief. So maybe I'm missing something and I'll ask them about it. But in Bryce, Bryce was a Section 3509 case, and we held specifically that the statute is, quote, not an affirmative disclosure statute, but rather forbids disclosure of sensitive information. And that was a case where trying to get access to certain sealed materials. So, well, you're not aware of the case, right?
No, sorry. First of all, I noticed that I've gotten into my rebuttal time. Is it all right?
That's okay. You can keep going. I have a question about the your argument about 18-year-old limits.
Yes.
So under your theory, if there is a, say a very graphic photograph of a 16-year-old, that document is not protected once that person becomes an adult. Is that right?
I think that it would be protected, but not under this particular statute.
But why would Congress have passed such a statute?
Because, Your Honor, I think, first of all, Congress was adding an additional layer of protection on top of all of the protections that already existed. Obviously, within the FOIA context alone, there are Exemption 6 and Exemption 7C.
But let's just stick with the statute for a minute.
Of course.
I take your argument about the definition of a child, but the Dictionary Act says you still have to look at context. So this statute refers to documents that, quote, concern a child. That's the language, right? Quote,
yes.
Concern a child. So is a photograph of is a graphic photograph of a 17-year-old no longer a document concerning a child when that 17-year-old is 25?
I think it's I certainly think that's a plausible reading of the statute. I think that there are two problems with it, one textual and one in terms of consequences. Mm-hmm. In terms of the text, again, I think if we're talking colloquially in terms of saying what
I don't even see why, excuse me, but I don't understand why a photograph of a 17-year-old when that person is 25 is not a photograph of a child?
I think, again, because there's a statutory definition as opposed to our normal way of thinking about what a child is, and the statutory definition refers to a person who is under the age of 18.
But the Dictionary Act makes it very clear that you look at the context and the purpose of the statute, and and besides, yeah,
Yes, of course, Your Honor. And there again, I think a couple of things. One, the overall context of the statute and the purpose of the statute is meant to help people while they are children be able to tell their stories to law enforcement and to be able to testify at trial. And so again, the vast majority of the statute doesn't make any sense once someone turns 18. You know, appointing a guardian ad litem for someone once they're 18 doesn't make any sense. It has some legal problems with it. Same with having an adult attendant there and having the child be able to sit on their lap or hold their hand, which is something in the statute.
Those provisions do not use the term concerning a child, right? So they all refer to a child. And so maybe that definition makes sense as someone under 18, you know, with respect to those provisions. But to Judge Tatel's point, I mean, why is a picture of a minor, you know, of a child, not always a document concerning a child? Because the document itself, the photo, or, you know, whatever material is in that document is always concerning a child, even if that person is now an adult.
Well, I think, again, this gets into problems of application as well. I think that it would have, you know, if we go beyond just thinking about a photograph, this would have some applications that seem very much at odds with the statute. So if you have someone who's 50 years old and for the first time comes out and says, when I was 10 years old, I was assaulted, and gives a statement to police. Under this reading of concerning a child, that statement would have to be kept under lock and key forever, because the person it's describing events that happened when this person was 10 years old, but they're 50 years old now. That's when they made the statement. They're miles away from being a child.
They may still have a privacy interest in not having the public know, you know, some horrible acts that happened to them when they were a child. I'm not sure why that would change whether the crime came out when someone was a minor or came out when someone was an adult. The privacy interest, I'm not sure why the privacy interest would be, you know, would be any different. And also that doesn't explain this, you know, concerning language, which seems to me, unless I'm missing something, only to be used with respect to the privacy protections, right? Suggesting that that is something different, right? You know, it's concerning a child. I think they use it, the statute uses that phrase multiple times in the context of the privacy protections, but not in the context of the other treatments of a child.
Right, Your Honor. Right. And I think that, again, this is a matter of not thinking about the word child colloquially and inserting the statutory definition of a child and thinking about it, again, in context, as Judge Tatel pointed out, looking at what the statute is trying to do. Because again, yes, they certainly have privacy interests if you're a 50-year-old and you're talking about something that happened when you were 10. But the question is, was this statute meant to deal with that privacy interest, or were previously existing doctrines, First Amendment balancing tests, for example, and in the FOIA context, exemptions 6 and 7C, were those already enough to handle that? And here, Congress was just trying to say, when we have a situation where we have children, a person who is under the age of 18, and they are in need of help in terms of telling their story to law enforcement and participating in the proceedings as they're occurring. And that's why it makes sense to think of this and to take the statutory definition seriously and to say it's referring to someone who is under the age of 18.
Forgive me for interrupting you a moment.
Of course.
But even without regard to the policy points that Judge Tatel raises, I read the statute the following way. I read the statute as 3509A defines who is the person we're talking about in the rest of the statute. And that's a person who is under the age of 18 when the crime takes place. Then you just take that person, the child, who you've defined in 3509A, and then you go to 3509D1, and it's the same child all throughout 3509D1, I and double I. That's the way I read it, without even having the kids consider the policy questions.
Well, I think, Your Honor,
are the purpose.
Yeah, I think the problem there is that it adds words to the statutory definition. It adds the words when the offense occurred, a person who is under 18 at the time the offense occurred. And we pointed to a number of statutes in our reply brief that actually do that. When Congress wants to set the reference point as the time at which the offense occurred, it says that. It either explicitly says under 18 when the offense occurred or something similar to that, or it says, you know, in the juvenile justice statute, it talks about a person who's under 18 when they committed the crime. And here it doesn't do that. And again, I point out that, you know, if we're looking beyond just the privacy provision, because the statutory definition applies across the entire statute, many, many provisions of this statute don't make very much sense if you're keying this to the time of the offense and someone could be far older than 18 at the time the trial is occurring, and you're talking about appointing a guardian ad litem, you're talking about an adult attendant, you're talking about having a competency hearing to determine whether they are able to testify. These are all provisions that are dealing with the situation that Congress had in mind, which is someone who is still a child in the midst of these proceedings and wanting to testify.
But that's,
well, even under your argument, the best you would make is that it's ambiguous, right?
At the very least, I think it's ambiguous. And I think when you're dealing with this question of a withholding statute, I think that's something to pay attention to. I don't think, obviously, that means you need to have an unambiguous statute here, because we're just dealing with FOIA as opposed to the entire interpretation of the statute. But I think it's something to keep in mind. I would also point out that you only get this far if you first get past the question of whether this is a withholding statute to begin with.
Right.
And for the reasons we stated, we don't think it is to begin with.
Okay.
Find your argument on that point rather weak because of the word only. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Unless my colleagues have any other questions, are you okay, Judge Rao? Judge, okay.
Yes, that's
right. Let's hear from the government and we'll give you a little time on rebuttal.
Okay? Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Peter Pfaffenroth for the government. The privacy question. This entire provision that we've been discussing is about privacy protection and quote unquote confidentiality of information. And it's about protecting children. That's what Congress was doing by enacting this statute. The notion that the statutory language defining child somehow evaporates when someone becomes 18, because that happens to be the moment when they testify, or that happens to be the moment when the victim finally takes the stand or a witness finally takes a stand, just doesn't make sense in either logically or in terms of the statutory language itself. You are a victim the moment that Mr. Corley sexually traffics you. And in this case, the jury found that each of the girls was underage at the time. And that issue is simply, you know, settled law. The Second Circuit has affirmed it, and it's a done issue. Yes.
Excuse me, counsel. Would you agree with your opponent that the statute is ambiguous?
I don't think it is.
What about you're reading it as child is defined as a person who is or was under the age of 18. Isn't that correct? That's the way you're reading it.
I don't think that's actually a necessary way to read it.
No, that's the way you're reading it. Isn't that the way you're reading it?
I'm reading it that, Judge Silverman, I don't mean to fight you on this, but the person is a victim at the moment that they are sexually trafficked, and that status never ends.
Excuse me, counsel, go right ahead and fight. It's your job.
Thank you, Judge. I just don't see it as being ambiguous, Your Honor. The person is a victim, and that person will remain a victim for all time because she was sexually trafficked by Mr. Corley when she was 16 years old. She is a victim forever. Yes, hopefully she'll live to a ripe old age, but she'll still be a victim of sexual trafficking of a minor.
I think I understand your point. Let's assume, however, arguendo, that it's ambiguous. Then what?
Then Congress did the balancing, and the reality is that the notion that FOIA is a disclosure statute and therefore we have to err in favor of disclosure, that notion really doesn't have much force in the Exemption 3 context where Congress has already done the balancing, right? If we were talking about some of the national security statutes that, you know, are well established as Exemption 3 withholding statutes, even if there was a little bit of ambiguity there, the fact is Congress determined that national security secrets need to be kept secret. And we're not going to interpret that ambiguity in favor of a requester because Congress already did that balancing.
But you didn't quite answer what is the doctrinal basis on which we would decide in your favor if we concluded Section 3509A was ambiguous? We can't give deference to the agency under FOIA or the Privacy Act, can we?
No, not. There's not a single, the Department of Justice as the agency that is applying all of these criminal statutes and is the agency that is clearly charged under the statute with, you know, prosecuting the individual. I mean, the Department of Justice is actually referenced in Section D1B.
Are you suggesting we owe deference to justices?
I'm not suggesting that. I don't think that, you know, this is a, nonetheless, I mean, the fact is, if there were any such agency, it would be DOJ.
The fact is we don't, correct?
You don't. No, that's true.
Okay, so why don't you just set that aside? Isn't the answer to Judge Silverman's question, well, you then look at the policy underlying the statute? Doesn't that help us?
Certainly.
Or doesn't that help you?
Absolutely.
He would say, if I may rephrase Judge Shadle, is this a legitimate place to look at the purpose of the statute? And his hypotheticals, if you think about them, are a reduction to absurdity. His hypothetical of the picture being distributed on the internet 20 years later is so horrifying, Congress could not possibly have meant that, isn't it?
That's right, Judge Silberman. The purpose of the statute clearly is to both protect the privacy of the individual who was victimized as a minor and to keep protecting that person, right? The statute talks about keeping the material under seal, and there's no time when that sealing expires in the statute. And Congress also, I think it is reasonable to infer, given the overall provisions of Section 3509 in terms of facilitating potentially very nervous children to participate fully and meaningfully in criminal prosecutions of their assailants, would want to provide a variety of ways of making those children comfortable. And other provisions talked about, you know, having a guardian ad litem or somebody that they can sit on the lap of or what have you. But this provision was all about the privacy, and many children would reasonably, and their parents who are advising them and things like that, would reasonably be very concerned about the long-term implications of the facts underlying this prosecution coming out later and causing re-victimization to the children.
I don't care for normally referring to the purpose of the statute as opposed to the text, but if there ever was an example where it might be legitimate, it might be in this case. If we were to decide on this issue against you, the Supreme Court would reverse 9-0 because they don't care about text as much as purpose.
Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court has already hinted, or well, not even just hinted, it's said how it feels about this issue generally before Section 3509, what became law in Globe newspaper, where it talks about the critical importance of protecting against psychological and other harm to child victims of sexual abuse.
Yep.
I asked Mr. Boquette-Lindell about U.S. versus Bryce. Do you know about that case?
Your Honor, I confess that in my research, I clearly missed it, and I apologize.
Judge Tatel, is that
you know the case? I mean,
I don't know the case. I'm happy to research it.
Maybe I just missed something. That's okay.
Judge Tatel, is that your
opinion? Just curious about why no one cited.
I'm sorry.
No, not me.
It's not your opinion.
No.
If it would be helpful to the court, I'd be happy to research it and submit a letter or whatever you'd like.
No, that's okay. No need to. No.
The last thing we need in this case is longer briefs.
I hear you, Your Honor. It is a little bit of a challenge when I had a lot of briefs, including from the pro se appellant, that I had to respond to.
Right.
Any other questions? Do you have anything else you want to add to the, what about the, anything you want to say about the other issues?
I would like to rest on our briefs, Your Honors, and if I would simply ask that the decision be affirmed.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Boquette-Lindell, you can take 2 minutes.
Thank you. First, just a couple of points on that, and then a couple of points on the issues that hadn't been discussed. First, as the textual point that Mr. Pfaffenroth was making about a victim or witness being a forever status, that's very much true. And so grammatically you say someone is a victim or witness forever. That's not the same when you're saying someone is under the age of 18. Once you turn 18, to say that this person is under the age of 18 no longer makes any grammatical sense. So I think that those two things, even though you use is for both, grammar clearly creates a difference there. Also, think that again, you're having to balance constitutional rights here. And the Globe newspaper decision shows that there are other ways to balance these rights aside from just this statute. So we don't necessarily have to read the policy of the statute to the ends of the earth in order to—
What are the constitutional rights at issue in a FOIA request?
Well, it's not about the FOIA request, Your Honor, it's about the statute itself. And in the statute itself, Congress was balancing privacy rights against the constitutional rights of the defendant. If the defendant and the defendant's counsel were not allowed to receive a lot of these documents, you could have Brady problems, you could have—
But that balancing, you acknowledge, is not at issue here.
It is in the sense that Exemption 3 is about the underlying statute. It's not so much about FOIA's interests, it's about what does the statute itself say and what is the statute itself doing. And when you're just doing a statutory interpretation of the Child Victims Act, I think you do have to consider the fact that there was this balancing going on in the creation of the statute itself. On the other issues, I want to point out that on the EOUSA Privacy Act issue, the only arguments the government has were that these are not agencies, even though clearly the statutory definition of agencies includes these subcomponents, and this court has gotten very close to the line of already saying that these are separate agencies. And as we point out in the reply brief, none of the documents that they point to actually shows that EOUSA made Privacy Act exemption arguments, and likewise didn't show that the Justice Management Division had not received the appeal letter from Mr. Corley on that issue. I see I've gotten over my time.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Mr. Boquette-Lindell, you were appointed by the court to serve as amicus, and we're grateful to you for your assistance. Thank you.
May I add to that?
Yes.
Judge Tatel?
Please.
I think it was a superb brief.
Yes.
And an excellent argument.
Thank you very much, Justice Silverman. I appreciate that.